Greetings and welcome to the latest edition of the Entheogenic Evolution Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Martin, and I'm happy to have you with me today with what is the very last podcast episode for 2023, also the last podcast episode marking the 15th year of the Entheogenic Evolution Podcast, and everything that comes out after this will be in year 16 and beyond, which I personally think is pretty cool. For this podcast episode, I've got John Kamen, who I interviewed actually a couple months ago now, so it's been a while since we've had this conversation, but John runs a website called freshminds.com, and that is spelled F-R-S-H-M-I-N-D-S.com. There is no vowel in the word fresh. And what John has done is he has visited a number of psychedelic retreats around the world, and he has compiled a bunch of information about them. And so this is a great website as a resource for finding out information about different psychedelic retreats, and he has it organized into different categories like ayahuasca retreats, psilocybin retreats, and it's just a great resource for anybody who wants to, you know, look into what might be the best fit for you and your retreat needs and desires. I will say that when we had this conversation that unfortunately John's time ran out, so we didn't get to a few things that I did want to talk about that were up on the website, but you know, maybe that will just encourage you to go check out the website even more. So we'll leave it at that, but just to let you know, we do have a bit of an abrupt ending to our conversation as there is something else urgent on John's immediate schedule and he had to jump to that, but I'm sure that you will enjoy the conversation anyway. I don't really have a lot of announcements to make. I'm actually recording this a week early because tomorrow, which will be a week ago when this comes out, I am getting on a plane with my family and we are traveling for the duration of the rest of the year. So I am not at home when this comes out, so I'm putting this out early. So if anybody has made a contribution in support of the podcast or joined up as a patron over at my Patreon page at patreon.com/MartinWBall over the past week or so, thank you very much. Really appreciate it. And I will get to thanking you on air when I return and put out the very first episode for 2024 when the Entheogenic Evolution Podcast turns 16 years old. Yep, sweet 16. I did want to remind you, as I mentioned in last week's episode, that for my end of the year musical giveaway offering, I am making my album, The Fate of Marani, the soundtrack, available for free download over at my Bandcamp page at martinball.bandcamp.com. If you would like to get this collection of, I think it's 14 songs, is that right? Just let me check here. I think it's 14 songs. It's like an hour and 15 minutes of really cool instrumental music. Yep, 14 songs, 1 hour and 12 minutes long. And I personally think that this is some great music to do some journey work on, man. Put some headphones and a blindfold on, and man, you are going to go places. And I've taken it out myself for a few spins. I really like this album. I made it to support the audiobook to my novel, The Fate of Marani. Recorded it earlier this year. It's just a really, in my opinion, a really nice mix of electronic music, world fusion. There's some ambient stuff in there. There's birds that I recorded in Costa Rica and on Haleakala in Hawaii, and sounds of the Costa Rican jungle at night. And just some really, really cool tracks. I really like this album. So it's available for free. If you want to grab it, just enter zero when you go to the Bandcamp page to download it, and it asks you for payment. Just put in zero, and it is yours for free. Okay, so that's my gift to you, to anyone who would like to receive that. I am working on my schedule for January for consultations. I, of course, am available for 30, 60, and 90-minute calls to help you integrate your entheogenic experience from a non-dual and energetic perspective. And as I do sometimes mention, I also do support people who facilitate medicine experiences and help you review whatever it is that's going on with you and offer some advice and feedback and support. Just know I am there for you. And let's see. I think that's about it for right now. I hope that your year is wrapping up beautifully for you. If you celebrate Christmas, it's Christmas Day today that the day that this is actually being posted online. So Merry Christmas if that's your thing. And Happy New Year. Be safe. And looking forward to you joining me for yet another year of the Entheogenic Evolution podcast starting in January of 2024. Very cool. All right. Here is John Kamen from freshminds.com. FRSHMINDS.com. Okay. Well, my guest today here on the Entheogenic Evolution podcast is John. He's not a crocodile. Kamen. Just had to put that in because we just clarified how to pronounce his last name. And it's not spelled like Kamen, as in like the crocodilian. But anyway, John, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks very much. I think in Eastern European languages, it means fireplace. So 200 years ago, one of my ancestors was shoveling coal into something.
Oh, okay, cool.
There you go.
Yeah, well, John Fireplace. yeah, it's great to have you here. And you originally reached out to me that you've got this website that we're going to be talking about, Fresh Minds, which is a very interesting compilation, maybe just reference material around psychedelic retreats. And so we're going to spend a lot of time sort of talking about what's in there and what you've discovered in doing this research. But let's start with you, John, just to get to know you. As I mentioned, Fresh Minds is about specifically about psychedelic retreats and resources related to that. But sort of what's your position within psychedelics? How did you get interested in it? And then we'll get into how you got interested in this question of retreats.
Yeah, for sure. So, Toronto guy, I've had a career in media for, sort of 15 years. And ended up, as a lot of people did, in Canada's legal cannabis industry, just as it was moving towards legalization, and had the great benefit of working for a couple of years with my partner now here at Fresh Minds. He was the CTO of a company called Lift & Co. That was the cannabis company. We were doing some great stuff, actually. We had the largest consumer trade shows in the country, so there were sort of 20,000 people coming down to the convention center over the course of a weekend. We worked with all of the major producers, so Canopy and Aurora and all the guys who were sort of driving that space from a public markets perspective. They were all our clients. And we were really sort of central to the industry. We had collected a lot of really interesting data from users, so sort of product review data, and spun that up into an app that was live in the store and would allow consumers anywhere across Canada at the time to walk into a legal store and rather than sort of sit down with a bud tender, just actually go to the app and get a sense for, quality and, what kinds of terpenes were in there and, is it good for anxiety relief or keeping me awake or whatever. So really cool stuff. We had a data business that was emerging and unfortunately, COVID killed the business. I was probably one of the very first people in the entire country to get excised when COVID hit that day, when everybody sort of went home. That was the last day of Lyft as an operating company. So long story short, really sad, really depressing that, we were right on the cusp of doing amazing stuff, branching out into the US, and all of a sudden, myself and my partners were just sort of sitting around like, oh, okay, well, I guess as my CTO partner often says, man plans and God laughs, and it was kind of like that. So what are we going to do, right? Psychedelics obviously was kind of emerging from that sort of corporate business, cowboy capitalism perspective as being a great, sort of the next wave of where that capital, but where that thinking goes. We said, okay, like my partner, much more sort of a psychonaut than I was at the time. I was actually pretty newbie to this world. And said, okay, let's take a look at it. I didn't know a whole heck of a lot. And over the last 3 years, I can say I feel like I've earned a PhD in psychedelic assisted therapy. It's the science is compelling. The stories, the testimonials that you hear from people in the industry or from people who are working with us now as partners, why they decided to go into the space and build out a retreat and put the rest of their lives on hold or sort of move in a different direction is so compelling, universally, that you end up just getting sucked right in. And it's, I know there's a little bit of, for those who are coming from the cannabis space, there's a little bit of kind of, okay, here we go again, right? Like, thanks very much, guys, but this is different. And while I appreciate that's true, it didn't really resonate with me, exactly how powerful this was and what it really was all about and the nature of the differences between this and cannabis. And the more I learn and the more people that I talk to and the more good stuff that we do as a company, the more appreciative I am, and frankly, the happier I am that we've decided to go this way. So that's kind of how we got here.
Yeah. So let's just talk about Canada just for a minute. I'm just kind of curious sort of what your assessment of sort of things on the ground, like there in Toronto. For example, I was doing an integration call with somebody in Vancouver the other week, and he told me that he got his 5-MeO DMT by going down the street and going to a shop, and he bought it at a shop. And he said, oh yeah, and they have DMT and they have salvia and there's mushrooms and everything else is available there in the shop. And I just bought a 5-MeO vape pen and I went home and tried it for myself. Yeah. And it's a little bit surprising to hear that. I know that a lot of these things have been decriminalized. 5-MeO DMT is still unregulated, right, and people are practicing above ground. But just what's your sense of how things are, and particularly, you know, Toronto is not Vancouver. So is it similar in Toronto, or what's the situation like?
Yeah, Vancouver, much as in the U.S., where you've got, you know, sort of West Coast cities leading the charge in terms of normalization, you know, reducing the policing down to sort of minimum level of concern, or, you know, whatever the terminology is there. And Vancouver kind of leads Canada and always has, right? I mean, these stores are actually not that novel. I think there's been shroom shops operating openly in downtown Vancouver for decades. The addition of 5-MeO, I mean, they might have been there all along, and I just never even thought to ask about it, right? I think it's still a little obscure for the average person. Toronto is sort of catching up a little bit, but it's fits and starts, right? What we saw with cannabis in, you know, over the last 10 years prior to regulation or legalization was the, you know, the opening of these illegal shops all over town that, you know, they weren't hiding what they were doing, right? There was a big banner outside and, you know, guy with a sandwich board saying, come on in for your weed. And interestingly enough, you know, they were very well frequented. They all made tons and tons of money. And they would get shut down probably once a month. You know, cops would storm in and find them, and, you know, they'd pay the fine and out of cash earned that week, and they'd be right out and opening up again. The shroom stores, it's kind of similar. I've heard that one of them, not that far from where I live, actually, has been shut down recently. I don't know that the receipts that they're getting are similar to what they were in the cannabis days. I think there's just so much more usage in the population for cannabis that, you know, and I personally kind of question whether distributing psychedelics out of the corner store is the best distribution method for that type of product, for a whole bunch of reasons. But yeah, it's, if I wanted to go buy shrooms right now, I could probably walk there from my front door.
Yeah. It's interesting here in Oregon. That's definitely something that you can't do. We of course have lots of cannabis is available. We have sort of the fledgling psilocybin therapy program that's going on, and that also includes like no distribution of psilocybin or psilocybin products in any kind of way. So we don't have anything like that. Years ago, salvia used to be available at like smoke shops here in Oregon, and I don't think you can find that anywhere these days. So we've also decriminalized a lot of things with the effort to redistribute monies from incarcerating people into treatment. And all the studies have shown that actually that's just been a complete failure here in Oregon, that the resources just aren't there, that people are not getting treatment. So there's even the reconsideration around the decriminalization that was put through a couple years ago. But it's just everything's kind of up in the air in those regards. And even with the psilocybin treatment, there's not a lot of facilitators who have been certified yet. It does look like it's rather expensive. So it's kind of out of range for a lot of people, which is why I think retreats are becoming ever more significant in that sense, that might be more financially accessible for people, even though it usually involves travel.
Yeah, I would agree. I think I look at sort of, you know, cost of treatments for ketamine or, you know, some of what's going on in Oregon within the legal environment. Sure. I mean, you know, one of our most trafficked articles is, does my health insurance cover all of these things? And well, no, obviously it does not. So, yeah, I think the retreats, I think that, you know, the biggest issue that we've got, you know, and I'll call it loosely an industry. There's so many people doing so many different things, but they're all kind of going at the same goal. And I think the biggest challenge we've got there is education, right? So when I talk to an average consumer, a new user to Fresh Minds, you know, might have done shrooms once, doesn't really understand what's going on here. We just launched out a tool right out on our homepage. We call it the Retreat Selector Tool. And the idea was that a user coming to my site doesn't even know what questions to ask. They don't know, you know, you mentioned 5-MeO. I guarantee 99.9% of the people coming to my site have never heard of that before. They don't even know what it is. So, you know, they don't understand the range of options that are in front of them, and they don't understand how individualized and personalized the experience really sort of should be, and trying to find that right match with, you know, the plant medicine you're using and the setting and, you know, the practitioners that you're working with and all those things, right? I mean, it's quite weighty. There's a lot in there. And I think the average person just doesn't even know what questions to ask. So when it comes to the cost, you know, and retreats, I think the first question, if your dog starts going, my dog's probably going to start going too.
Yeah, yeah. You know, we've got this green space back here, and a lot of deer and wild turkeys go back and forth. And so.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. I try and tell her, like, don't bark, but, you know, she doesn't listen to me. So sorry that Moxie is interrupting you.
Not at all.
A problem. I'm going to have to, you know, put her somewhere where she can't see the deer and the turkeys. Sorry. So you were saying.
Yeah. So I think, you know, when you talk about the cost and, you know, that first at first blush, like, you know, that sticker shock kind of, you know, causes people to think about it. They don't really understand that actually you're paying for the therapy, right? Like that's what's driving the cost here. It's not the plant medicine, but I guarantee you, 9 out of 10 people you'd ask on the street, just they don't have it. They get it backwards. So education is really important. I think that sites like ours, and, you know, we're not the only ones who are sort of trying to do something similar. You need to have that resource. And the reality is people's attention span is so short. You've got to catch them right as they're looking for that information, like serve it up to them before they even knew they were looking for it. It's the only way to get around this problem.
Yeah. So then what kind of prompted this interest specifically on focusing on retreats? Is it because of that's where a lot of the access is happening, or?
You know, a couple of things, right? I think it really did boil down to the education piece. You know, when I think about what we, you know, my partner and I sort of really bring to the table here is, you know, we're digital consumer marketers, right? That's what we've always done. I've always worked in a marketplace environment. And really, you know, when we started off in sort of building out Fresh Minds and building a lot of content and a lot of insight, you know, what that business model would be, it really came down to this question, right? Like, what's the problem we're trying to solve? You know, how can we actually help here? The world doesn't need yet another resource of, you know, what is 5-MeO and what's that experience like and everything. It's not that hard to find right now, right? So, as we really started to think about that, you know, the great benefit of working in a space like psychedelics is that for me, I've spent the last 15 years fighting Google and Facebook, right? And anytime you come up with an idea, well, they're going to take it. And I've long had conversations, you know, in other sectors where you're like, okay, well, what's Google going to do? And what could our defense be? Well, nothing. Fact of the matter is, in spaces like cannabis or psychedelics or presumably other vice categories, you know, they're the brakes are on, right? They don't sort of actively embrace it. They may take down your page. They may reject your ads. You know, you've got to put all kinds of funny characters in. And, you know, for us as digital consumer marketers, it's such a great opportunity to build something meaningful, right? That's something that the world needs that people haven't even thought about yet. And got some good ideas coming down the pipe that we're hoping are really going to help, you know, sort of with that consumer education piece that otherwise no one's going to touch.
Yeah, I'm just curious if you could tell a little bit more about the funny characters issue. So this is something I don't spend a lot of time on social media. You know, I have a Facebook account. I have an Instagram account. Yeah. I post stuff. I don't spend a lot of time there, but I have seen recently a lot of people, you know, when they're writing psychedelics, like the word, they're putting in a lot of different characters or that, you know, they're doing dashes and spaces and things like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've been doing this podcast since 2008. It's called The Entheogenic Evolution. I post my episode every Monday morning. I've never had an issue. And maybe it's because I'm using the word entheogenic. I don't know. I'm not specifically using the word psychedelics, but has something recently changed there that there's more policing around the use of this language that you're aware of? Or just tell us a little bit more about sort of these blocks by Google and social media.
Yeah, I think the challenge that you've got with these guys is that you don't get any real heads up when they've made a change to their policy or their policing or their algorithms. And once they've done that, if you were offside inadvertently, it's too late, right? I mean, good luck getting somebody on the phone. You basically have a better chance knowing the president personally than getting someone on the phone at Facebook. So I think that the challenge is outside of Facebook, it's never been entirely clear what those, you know, what rules sort of drive that. Now, I've had a page taken down in the cannabis space, our page we had to reclaim, and it took us months. So the threat is real. And we were not selling any product in that space. It was purely media, right? So it was kind of enabling the industry, but there was no transactions. We weren't doing anything illegal. It was all above board. We were publicly traded. So the threat is there. And the problem is, you know, you just don't have anybody to call when they've made a mistake. So I think, you know, just through sort of virality, people sort of come up with all sorts of little solutions, whether they actually help or not, it's anybody's guess. I think if you make a play to more directly try to sell something that is derivative of plant medicines through any of those pages, you're right in the crosshairs. Then you're playing with fire would be my estimation. But to be honest, outside of Facebook and Google, I'm not sure anybody really necessarily knows.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks. Again, going back just to Canada itself, kind of what have you found in terms of the distribution of legal psychedelic therapy, which might just be limited perhaps to ketamine at this point, and retreats that, you know, usually when we think of retreats, just like going to Fresh Minds, and by the way, just for the audience, it's freshminds.com and it's FRSH. So there's no vowel in
there.
Freshminds.com. Yeah. Often when we're thinking of retreats, we're thinking of tropical locations. That's where these tend to happen in a lot of instances. And this is where legally people have access to be able to, you know, put up a retreat and advertise and serve and things like that. So we talked a little bit about, you know, the corner shops, but are there also the development of retreats that are happening in Canada? And do they have to be underground? Are they able to be above ground? Sort of where are they at?
Yeah, so it's a bit of an interesting mix. We don't really have the church phenomenon, the religious exemption phenomenon that exists in the U.S. So there are retreats. There are some operating right out in plain sight legally because they've basically decided that they'll use cannabis as their psychoactive until such time as they're allowed to use other plant medicines. They work with us right now. They're, you know, the one I'm thinking about is called Dimensions Retreats. It's about 3 hours north of Toronto. Out west, particularly sort of in British Columbia and in the interior, in the mountains, there's a great deal of retreats there. I could probably think of half a dozen off the top of my head. They are, for the most part, operating, I don't want to say below ground, subterranean, because they're not necessarily shying away from advertising, but they would not be in the operating within the bounds of the law, as I understand it. And it's interesting, right? I mean, it does raise this question where you've got a number of people who are practitioners, and some of them obviously, you know, working right outside of their house. And they'll want to work with us, but we will take great pains to try to, you know, maybe not give their exact location or specifically what plant medicine they're using, and, you know, just sort of respect their confidentiality as best we can. And so far nobody's asked about it, so should be all right.
Yeah, it's an interesting edge to walk of wanting to be public, being concerned about how much are you exposing yourself.
Yeah.
Will the authorities even care or not?
Right.
You know, or just the capriciousness that perhaps at some point maybe they haven't cared for the past few years, and all of a sudden, oh, okay, now we're gonna bust these people. Certainly creates a lot of uncertainty for people who are working in the space. And, you know, it's obviously there's a lot of disagreement in the psychedelic community over whether there should be psychedelic therapy, what retreats, even churches. You know, apparently somebody gave a talk at the Big Maps conference that happened a few months ago, and his talk was, I don't know the title, I wasn't there, but it was something along the lines of, don't open a psychedelic church, was his opinion. And I'm not sure what the argument was there, but as you've mentioned, that's a huge phenomenon that's going on in the United States right now. And some of them have done the paperwork, some of them have not done the paperwork, but they're kind of taking the place of retreats and also even therapy. So a lot of the same things are happening at these churches and at the retreats and at the therapeutic spaces, but it's all under different umbrellas, and people are having different training or lack of training, or, you know, whatever it may be. So it's a real wild west that we're kind of experiencing right now.
I think that the risk should always be kind of commensurate with the penalties, right? And I think for the vast majority of people who are running through one of those programs, they're going to have a great experience or a benign experience, and it's going to be fine, and they're going to be perfectly fine afterwards. And for those one in a millions or whatever the actual stat is, I'm sure it's a little bit less than that, that aren't going to have a great experience and might actually have some longstanding complications afterwards, you know, there is a little bit of, you know, I keep advocating for regulation and standardization. Yeah. I keep saying, you know, for anyone who's willing to listen, in February this year, I was down in Costa Rica and Mexico. I actually got to meet 30 operators all over the countries and just traveled around, and you get a real sense for how different people are operating. You go to Arrhythmia and you've got 100 people there at any one time. You've got people operating out of their house and you get a shared bedroom, sort of one-to-one. So it's really the whole spectrum. And, you know, what I kind of picked up while I was there is that the ayahuasca centers in Costa Rica are trying to organize. They're actually trying to figure out, number one, who's who. Let's just build a list and figure out who's operating. And second of all, you know, are there things that we should be doing to try to lobby the government should they decide that rather than ignore what's going on here and sort of, unscheduled and irrelevant, it actually cracked down. And the comment that I made was that what you really need to do is, if you're going to advocate for yourself well, make sure that you are bringing some degree of standardization to the table. So at least you can say, we're looking out for our own best interests here. We're self-policing and you don't have to worry about this. And who knows what that standardization might be. It might be somebody trained with first aid credentials at any one time at a center. It might be somebody who's gone through some sort of, you know, integration therapy training or psychedelic assisted therapy training from somebody, right? It kind of fell on deaf ears. And I think the problem that the industry's got right now, it's so decentralized. You've got a lot of little, you know, little centers popping up, people who, you know, open a shaman shack is a great, you know, term that I've heard. They spend 2 weeks in the jungle and then suddenly disguise their ayahuascaros and they go out and plant the flag. And there is risk there. There is risk there. And I think the challenge that we've all got is that it only takes one bad outcome going viral, getting picked up in media, for the whole thing to get a real spotlight on it. And for 99.9% of the people who are going through these programs to no longer have access to them, right? If regulation comes down. So I think there's definitely risk there. And I think the only way to really, sort of solve for that right now is education of the consumer. They really need to know what they're buying, what the data is, what the risk factors are, be honest, understand the importance of an intake call, not make stuff up, you know, like they need to be educated to give them the best chance of having a good experience.
Yeah. Well, I want to return to that question of like what some of these regulations and standards really could be. But let's kind of dive into this project of Fresh Minds. And you mentioned going to Costa Rica and meeting with 30 different groups. And I'm really curious about the whole research process and where you got to go, what kind of questions you were asking. So let's dive into that. So let's start with maybe what was the germination for Fresh Minds?
Yeah, I think, as I was saying earlier, coming out of the cannabis space, we were trying to figure out where can we bring some value. So it was kind of around that marketplace idea. That's what we know. And you know, there was lots of different sort of, you know, areas within psychedelics that are emerging, right? There's trip sitters, you know, there's integration therapists, there's ketamine clinics, and of course, there's a litany of people selling illegal stuff, right, online. And I think when we think about what we bring to the table just in terms of solving problems, it really was around sort of the education piece, where it was just so hard to get someone to know what they need to know. And thinking about, you know, my travels, there was one moment that really sort of solidified it for me. And I was in Sayulita, which is just outside of Puerto Vallarta in Mexico, and having breakfast with an operator there. Our Future is Ancient was the name of the retreat. And she actually did something that very few other centers did. She actually brought along a guest from live programming, a live session that she was having, who I believe was from Germany. And I was asking her all kinds of questions. I was like, you know, there's a lot in here and there's retreat centers all over the world. You probably flew over 100 of them to get here from Europe. So what was it about this one? How long did it take you to decide that this was the best fit for you? And what was your process? And she basically said it took her 2 years to come to a decision. And that seemed a little egregious to me, but it makes sense. You know, I think we're all sort of talking the same language here. We all get inside our own bubble and we're, you know, really comfortable with the concept. You bring that average person in off the street and they don't know anything, right? I mean, they're literally starting from zero, and to get them to make a purchase decision of, you know, $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 without knowing anything is really challenging. So that was really where we said, okay, there is a big gap here. I think that, respectfully, you know, otherwise the retreat market's sort of being treated like it's an Expedia question. Like, if you tell me how much you want to spend and what beach you want to go to, I'll tell you where to go. But it's so much more complicated than that. And no one's doing a good job of that.
Yeah, I can definitely agree that there is a need for some kind of compendium of information around these things. Because as you say, that the numbers are just proliferating. There's more and more all the time. Yeah. I hear all the time of people saying, oh, yeah, I'm moving to Costa Rica and I'm opening up a retreat. And I'm moving to Mexico and I'm opening up a retreat. And so they're just springing up everywhere. And there is that question of, are you qualified? What do you actually offer? What are your safety protocols? What is your intake? And yeah, we're definitely dealing with a very different wave of interest in psychedelics. I mean, so yesterday I was at my son's soccer game, and one of the other mothers whose child was on the soccer team, you know, she asked me, oh, what do you do? And I said, oh, I work in psychedelic medicines. And she's like, oh yeah, that there's a lot happening with that right now. And you know, we kind of got in this conversation. I said, yeah, when I started in this field in 2006, like, that's the kind of thing that I would kind of wonder, like, should I tell the person flat out, or do I say that, oh, I work in spirituality, or, you know, stuff like that. And these days, you know, it's very easy to say, oh, I work in psychedelic medicine. She's like, oh yeah, I'm from Costa Rica. It's very popular there. I don't know much about it, but, you know, I saw the show on Netflix. And so it's like, yeah, this is the next wave of person who doesn't have any history here, doesn't have any skin in the game, is now aware. And even yesterday, talking to my mom, who lives in Northern California, she's like, yeah, you know, I'm seeing all this stuff on the news that I've known from you from years ago, but never saw mentioned anywhere. But now everybody's talking about it. So there's this whole new wave of interest in psychedelic experience and using that for personal growth, using it for therapy. And so the interest in these retreats has definitely grown. Yeah. But short of Fresh Minds here, I've never seen a website that actually puts together all of this information in one place that allows us to kind of go through the directory and compare and contrast and actually get into this information. So I see that there's a very strong need for it as more and more people are looking at this as an alternative form of either spirituality or, again, personal growth or some form of therapy.
Yeah, that's right. And I think when we thought about, you know, we started off sort of supporting some of the illegal dispensaries online. The reality is, I don't know if it necessarily matters that much what the formulation of psilocybin specifically is within these microdose capsules. You know, you're kind of going to get the same experience, whether it's, you know, whether any neuroplasticity is augmented or not, I don't know, right? I think that's an open question. And we kind of realized that, you know, trying to help guide consumers through that purchase, if that's where they were going, there's not much that we really need to help with there, right? They'll figure it out. Yeah. And they're not that hard to find. But I agree with you, you know, within retreats, it's so complicated. And it's so easy to just sort of pay lip service to it and just send somebody off to Costa Rica without knowing what they've even signed up for, what the guest to, you know, practitioner ratio is or anything. And then you hear people say, you know what, I didn't get much out of it. I didn't have a great experience. Like, okay, well, probably didn't know what you were buying. That might have been the main problem there.
Yeah. So let's talk about the research for this. And sounds like you got to do some travel, got to meet with people. Yeah, and you've shared a little bit about that, but I'm just curious for more details, more stories. Let's hear about where you went, what you saw.
I traveled, spent 2 weeks on the ground in Costa Rica, driving around from kind of coast to coast. There's little pockets within Costa Rica where it's just super concentrated, and there's tons of retreat operators sort of operating along the Pacific coast. Was great surfing. There's tons all up and down and all up and down the coast, and kind of deserted beaches up on these beautiful mountain, sort of majestic views. And then you get inland closer to the mountains, and then further into the south, sort of in a town called Uvita. There's probably two dozen or more retreats, you know, sort of being operated at a different scale. And, you know, the main takeaway for me was, again, not having previously been a psychonaut and just starting to get into that world personally now, because I do agree that you really need to kind of live it to understand. I think there's a lot of truth to that. When you go and meet the people who are working there or were the founders of these facilities, you hear the most incredible transformation stories of one form or another over and over and over again. Like, you know, people who were in the police force and had PTSD and found, you know, a solution for that through plant medicine. I remember, you know, someone who I was speaking to who's actually from just east of Toronto originally and now runs a facility. It's called Om Jungle. It's up on a mountain, sort of on the west side of Costa Rica. And her story was just incredible. I mean, she was dealing with multiple sclerosis for, if memory serves, it was like 2 decades, and progressively sort of deteriorated, was doing stem cell therapy, I remember. So there was a sort of more defined medical response to what she was going through, but really kind of felt like this was the end for her, and went out and tried ayahuasca for the first time and credits it at least partially with her complete remission. She's absolutely fine. You would never know she was dealing with anything. In speaking with her, now she's being asked to speak on, you know, the speaking circuit, in sort of defense of ayahuasca and the physical journey that it took her on. So you just hear stories like that almost every single day, and you just can't help be swept up by it. You know, you go to an Ibogaine clinic, everybody there has dealt with serious addiction problems and have found their way through it. And that's, they want to work there. They don't even care whether they're making a living or anything. They want to pay it forward and give back. And that's just, it's really compelling. It's really compelling.
Yeah. So I'm curious, did you find, obviously a lot of people who work in this space, they're inspired because they've had transformative experiences themselves. And we kind of touched on this a little bit earlier, but sometimes we have people who maybe they have just a minimal amount of experience and then they're so inspired, they're like, I want to open up a retreat. Did you find a lot of disparity between people who say, yeah, and I went through this long training program, or this is how, or is it more on the, we're just really inspired, we want to give back to others, we have that sort of pay it forward mentality? I'm just curious what you found there.
It's a bit of a mix, right? You meet people who had, you know, well-established credentials, and, you know, they were therapists of some kind and social workers, and, you know, they understand the care component of it. And the integration piece, I think, really, you know, is the most critical aspect of the journey, right? I mean, if you're not trained to do that properly, you're really kind of selling air, you know, vapor in my mind. Like that, if you're not helping them integrate after the journey, it's you're just sort of your caretaker, right? Trip sitting. So you get people who do have credentials to do that and understand the importance of that. I think you get other people who, yeah, it's the pay it forward. You know, I came here for a couple of reasons. Number one, to pay it forward. Number two, I didn't have a whole lot going on at home, so I'm gonna plant my flag down here now. And there, I think you're right. You know, there's some question, right? I mean, if they're all, I would say 95% of the people that I met, I would consider highly empathic and well-meaning practitioners, mm-hmm. Who may not know what they don't know, would be the biggest risk. And then you get the odd one who, you know, for a variety of reasons, just kind of rings your alarm bells. And it actually raises a big question for us as Fresh Minds. We get asked all the time, how do you curate who you work with? You know, how do you decide who is a good center? How do you decide who you would trust? And the reality is, for us to play policeman is actually really difficult, because on the one hand, we've got all the data, we've got all the relationships, and know who they are. On the other hand, I don't know when somebody says to me, oh, well, I read this Reddit post that something went down over here and these people are butchers and they don't know what they're doing. I'm like, well, that could be true, but I have no idea whether that's true or not. Like, you know, there's a lot of chatter all the time, and I'm like, unless I get police records from Peru or you know, there's something definitive, it's like, you're putting me in a really awkward position to just, you know, to call somebody guilty before I even know who they are or what the story is. And that's challenging, right? So it's hard to really peel back the layer there and see, like, what's really going on, who actually knows what they're doing. It's very difficult to tell. Very difficult to tell. I think as a consumer, look for credentials, get them on the phone, have a long chat with them. Who's actually going to be doing the work with you? You know, what's that practitioner to guest ratio? How much personal attention am I going to be getting? And have them describe their process of integration for you. You know, like, once you've left, are they going to just sort of say, yeah, well, you know, we'll have a Zoom call for 20 minutes and then you're good? Or are they going to follow you for a period of time? Are they going to be accessible? Those are important questions to ask.
Yeah. What kind of variability did you find with some of these factors? Again, not necessarily policing the retreats themselves, but did you find some that seem like, or at least sound like, they're doing a better job with some of these issues than others? Is there a lot of variability there, or are they all trying to sort of fulfill these various roles of intake, preparation, reflection, journeying, then integration and follow-up and things like that? Or is there a lot of diversity?
There is, and I'll tell you, for somebody coming from, you know, sort of this objective perch that I am, it's genuinely difficult to tell if there's one that's better than others, right? So, you know, the value of ceremony and indigenous tradition you could hear people sort of arguing both sides of that. You know, some say, well, this is absolutely incumbent on having a good experience. You know, this is generational knowledge. You know, they know how to practice with, you know, with the medicines best, and so we're going to follow them. And others are just like, hey, look, it's chemical, and we know how to provide therapy, so we don't really care, you know, if everybody dresses up and whatever. It's not relevant. And I think that's kind of – that probably depends on the individual, right? It probably depends on the consumer. I think that when you get into these highly individualistic questions around what's sort of this, you know, setting for you to have a good experience, and did you prepare yourself appropriately – I think there's probably multiple paths here that get you to the same place. I'm not sure that it's binary and there's either good or bad. So I've kind of bought into the notion that there's a lot of different ways to do this well. But there are some hallmarks that need to be provided. And as long as people were sort of saying, like, you know, integration is important to us, you know, we think about the ratio of guests. I only want to see one person at any one time because I need to devote all of my energy to this person and to their rehabilitation. I'm like, yeah, okay, that sounds like what I would expect to hear, and sounds very professional. I think the problems that really start to arise is when, you know, you hear all these people going down to Costa Rica, and the economics of these little businesses are challenging because there is sort of this very natural inclination to make it a one-to-one, right? If you're going to give somebody appropriate care, I mean, you know, Martin, like you don't necessarily want that person sitting with 25 other people being distracted, sharing right. stories. Like, they want personal attention through that integration yeah. period. And that flies at odds with scale and the economics of that P&L. So I think they're all trying to figure out how to make some money and make a living at this and turn it into something that they can sort of scale without forfeiting good care.
Yeah. Like, if you're running a retreat that at any given time has 100 participants, then if you're thinking like, well, if they even give each person 1 hour of personal integration work and reflection on a one-on-one basis, then that's 100 hours. I mean, there's not that many hours in a week.
Right.
And if you're constantly having a revolving door of that many people, and it's interesting, this kind of emphasis on, you know, the tradition. And if we look at traditional ayahuasca use, say in Peru, I mean, they weren't retreats, they weren't doing intake, they weren't doing medical screening. You know, this was a cultural phenomenon, people coming and drinking, and then there wasn't a follow-up and integration. So, yeah. So much of it is a new model, even if they are relying on, you know, some kind of traditional approach or traditional context or framing for what they're providing. But still, the whole idea of potentially screening participants, having integration, having some kind of psychotherapy, and then even combining it with things like ice water baths and breathing techniques. I mean, none of that's traditional Peruvian ayahuasca or stuff. You know, these are all imports in some way, or even doing yoga. I mean, that's...
Yeah,
that comes from a completely different part of the world. So we're seeing a lot of these things kind of mesh together within the retreats, and figuring out how to make that fit in a way that really is serving people. I think that it can be really easy for a retreat to say, oh, yeah, and we've got meditation and we've got yoga and we've got breathwork exercises and we've got beautiful vegetarian food for you. But how much does it really add to the fundamental process of we're working with powerful psychedelics and you might have trouble understanding what you're going through, you know?
That's right. Yeah, no, I could completely agree. And I think you speak about sort of the, you know, in the Amazon and sort of, you know, mimicking, you know, following along with their indigenous heritage and not worrying about psychedelics, psychotherapy and credentials and all that stuff. And that's all true. And I think that, you know, when you talk to the folks in Peru, or maybe, you know, folks who came from North America, or there's one gentleman we talk to all the time, he's from Australia. They're running a small ayahuasca center down there and gives me a little bit of the background on what's going on the ground and what they're all saying to each other. And I think that there are bad actors, right? I mean, he would certainly say that there are. And I think that it's not a bad idea to have fused these two worlds together. Because as much as the indigenous tradition is certainly there and you know, the results sort of speak for themselves over thousands of years of learned behavior, I think that bringing some rigor and credentials and Western sort of thinking around you know, sort of this entire experience, if all that does, I presume it's going to help, but I genuinely wouldn't know. I mean, you might know better than I would, but I think what it does is just prevent bad actors from acting badly. I think that you've got more people, more cooks in the kitchen, people who are credentialed. They can sniff out poor practice or a, you know, sort of a suboptimal experience for somebody and try to rectify that. So I think if you kind of fuse these worlds together, I think it's probably better for the consumer at the end of the day anyways.
Yeah. And also what you were mentioning earlier, like in regards to Costa Rica, how pretty much all of these centers, they're operating independently from each other. They haven't thought collectively, but just having that opportunity for everybody to come together and to give feedback to each other, you know, that's also a way of helping to create standards within a community where people can share. But if everybody is isolated, their own little island retreat, and nobody's communicating with anybody else. And then even sometimes you get the irate person who leaves a comment online, and they might even be leaving out, well, actually I was the asshole and they didn't want me to be the asshole and they wouldn't let me. So, but I'm, you know, doing my online vengeance, you know, that's something that happens as well. So as you say, it gets hard to separate, like what really is an accurate picture of what's going on here. And I think the more above board things can be, and the more quote unquote professional associations there can be, then there can be this mutual sharing and kind of a holding up of standards of, well, we want people to have good experiences. We want all of this to work well so that we can continue to do this. And we don't need, you know, we don't need to keep all our little dirty secrets, you know, in a sense.
There's a story that was going around a lot. I can't verify that it's true, but I'll tell you, it's been repeated for me in a couple of different places from people whose opinions I would presume are correct. There was a suicide a couple of months ago. Was it?
I've heard about story. This.
Which obviously is a really unfortunate outcome. And it was at the center that is probably most well known and is largest. And I'm not going to name it, but I think, you know, in the industry we would know. And there's a bit of a history, I understand, with those kinds of accusations from that center. And there was a vice takedown and all this stuff. The comment that I made in response was that, listen, when you've got 100 people running through a program at any given time, right? I mean, you've got a pretty good sample there. And the reality is everybody here is dealing with, you know, some degree of trauma or mental health, you know, concern of some kind. So the rate of suicidality there is going to be astronomically higher than it is in the general population. And what we don't know, at least I don't know, maybe somebody knows, did that person flag that they had suicidal intentions prior to arriving there? Did they hide anything in their intake call? Did they actually prepare appropriately? I think there's a lot of questions around that. And I think that it's very quick. It's very easy for a lot of actors in the industry to sort of, you know, throw darts at other actors, especially when you're sort of the behemoth of the industry and say, oh, okay, they don't know what they're doing. This is dangerous and we've got to shut them down. The reality is data speaks. You know, and I don't know what the data is. I don't know what the objective truth is there. So I think it probably behooves everybody to take a breath and think about the accusation and look for that data, look for that proof before you voice it. It could end up hurting everybody inadvertently for no good reason.
Yeah, and it's a really complicated question, because even if somebody says, yes, I have contemplated suicide in my past, and they also might say, and I'm also desperate because I need help. I haven't received help. I'm looking for something. And that is a lot of people who end up at these retreats that, you know, like you mentioned, the person with, I think you said multiple sclerosis, right? That you might have a debilitating condition or disease, and that's where too much medical screening, like if we want to be absolutist about it, it might actually prevent people from getting the kind of help that they want. And that might even lead them to more desperate measures. Okay, well, I'm going to go get some ayahuasca and brew it and drink it at home because the retreats won't let me in. So it is this question of how much screening is too much screening. And yeah, that if there's lots of different people coming through with lots of different potential disorders, that they're not everyone is going to do well, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they weren't treated with the best care, in the same way that somebody might be going to see a psychotherapist and still commit suicide. Right. We're not going to blame their psychotherapist offhand. I mean, maybe there will be information that says like, well, that was a really fucked up psychotherapist, you know?
Yeah.
So maybe, you know, when a school has a school shooting, we don't necessarily say, well, it's the school's fault.
Yeah.
Right. That, you know, people do things. So that is that question.
That's right. And I think that the real the real issue right now is that where you don't have the ability to go out and generate really good, you know, input output data, right? Like, I know that when I give 60,000 people this amount of psilocybin and they've been recorded as having these conditions, here's the outcome on a percentage basis. When you get to that level of knowledge and specificity around how to use these medicines and what the outcome's going to be, a lot of this stuff goes away, because then you've got a prescription, right? You're like, okay, well, no, you know, there's no question here anymore. We don't have to sort of decide which modalities we want to introduce and whether we want to be all indigenous or whether we want to bring Western practices. Like, there's definitive proof. If you do this, the best outcomes for the greatest number of people. I think until you get there, it's, you know, all these questions will continue. And I think that just, you know, it's really incumbent on authorities in Canada and in the US and elsewhere to allow that research to happen. I mean, just open it up and let's learn, right? I mean, I don't see that should be a difficult question for anybody to answer.
Yeah, it's a great argument for research teams to team up with retreats and specifically choose retreats with very different modalities, as you say, so we could start to get some data other than just, there's plenty of anecdotal reports. The psychedelic world has an overabundance of anecdotal reports, but we don't have a lot of hard research and data on right. Most of the questions that we're really interested in, especially as we're talking about large scale retreats, large scale therapeutic practices, things like that, that it's just such a gray area and so many different questions. And, you know, research is increasing, but it's probably not enough given that there's more and more retreats every day. There's more and more people going through psychedelic therapy programs, either above ground or underground. I mean, one of the things that's happening in the United States is a lot of people are just offering their own courses and their own certifications.
Right.
It's not legal. It's not regulated. There's no governing board to say, okay, are you checking all the boxes? But, you know, people are doing it because the interest is there, but we just don't have a lot of hard data. Like with this question with, should people who, or even let's say they have a family member who has a history of some kind of mental disorder, does that disqualify this individual from receiving therapy? Is that too dangerous for them? You know, that this is a question that comes up, but we don't really have a lot of information on
it. I'll tell you, so that actually came up with me. One thing that I kind of couched in this conversation is that I wasn't much of a psychonaut before. And part of the reason was because as I was preparing to go down to Costa Rica, I heard for the first time, actually, that if, forget about your mental well-being, if you've got a history of mental illness in your family, you could be at risk. And, you know, going two generations back, I do. So I went down to Costa Rica and I thought it was interesting, right? I just started asking all the centers that I met, like, hey guys, would you screen me out of your intake based on that? You know, sort of two generations back, but schizophrenia, pretty serious condition. And probably 80% of them said, no, don't worry about it. It's you, you know, you're not your grandpa and, you know, it's totally whatever. And it's fine. 20% of them were like, maybe just for liability purposes. They were like, yeah, I probably wouldn't tell you to go. To be honest with you, if I hear one person say that, it becomes really difficult for me to imagine going through with it. Right. Cause now you're taking on it. And who's right? I have no idea.
Right. And there's nowhere to turn. Like, well, where do I go get an answer on this?
Lots All of opinions, have, but nothing definitive.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's where, I mean, I've been a longtime supporter of let's have more research. Let's bring everything above board as much as possible.
Yeah.
And yes, that has financial implications. And some people get really, you know, squeamish around, oh, money, you know, and then even with the retreats, you know, the couching this is, well, this is sacred work. And then people say, well, how can you charge money for something that's sacred? You know, and
yeah, and
just gets
and they'll
thrown
say,
around.
You know, we're making it as accessible as possible, or we're not for profit or whatever. Yeah. Right? Like, you know, there's lots of ways around that. I do think that it is somewhat inhibiting for so many people to be thinking that way, because, look, it's reality. I mean, at the end of the day, if they're unable to generate a margin, they're not going to be able to eat, and they can't do the work. Right. I mean,
right.
We're asked all the time, you know, at some point we're going to be, we're free right now for our partners, actually. So it's really easy for them to work with us. At some point we won't be. And I just sort of say, you know, even for the not-for-profit centers, they're like, well, I don't know if I would want to pay. And I'm like, listen, don't think of it as marketing, which is kind of a dirty word, you know, it's stigmatized at this point within the industry. What is your whole goal here? You're trying to help more people. And if I can help you do that, and I'm charging something that's very fair and, you know, beneath the value that I've generated for you, everybody should be happy, right? Consumer was able to find the help that they wanted. You were able to help the person that you wanted, and, you know, and I helped connect the two of you, right? So we don't have to make it this sort of, you know, stigmatized, dirty language around it and all feel bad about it. It is the reality of our existence, right? I mean, there's no way around it. If anyone can find me a different path, I'm willing to accept it. But I like to eat sometimes. And,
yeah. We all live in a monetary economy, whether we want to or not. So. It's the reality. Yeah. So for this research, you went to Costa Rica. Did you travel to other places, like go to Mexico, go to Peru, Jamaica, some of these other spots? And So with these other locations, I'm curious, did you find, is it similar to what's going on in Costa Rica, or does each of these areas kind of have their own issues or,
I think that, you know, it's pretty similar, right? I think that the prevalence of certain plant medicines by country obviously is quite different. We're set to go down to Jamaica in about a month to meet a bunch of our partners on the island there. And obviously it's dominated by psilocybin. And is legal, right? So in that respect, they probably don't really have any issues other than how can we help more people and grow and work with you guys. When you go to Mexico, you know, it depends, right? I mean, ayahuasca has been chilled a little bit over the last few years. There was a high profile arrest for somebody trying to import it into Mexico. The large centers, I would say, in both countries, those that are better capitalized, dealing with more people, are generally kind of ambivalent, as far as I could tell, around the law and, you know, whether the state is suddenly going to get interested in this or crack down or anything. It's kind of tourist infrastructure and we can afford good lawyers, so we're fine. A lot of the independent operators are very worried about it and try to stay quiet and subterranean, and, you know, they'll put billboards up or try to advertise without making it really easy to contact them. And I think it's an interesting disparity, you know, like why would the little guys be more worried about getting shut down than the big guys? I think it's just they can't afford the legal representation, right? Yeah. But otherwise, it's pretty similar. I think, you know, wherever there are pockets where people wanted to go on vacation, you've got retreats popping up all over the place, right? So they tend to get the best beaches and great mountaintop sort of jungle hideaways that with these spectacular views. And it's I didn't experience a lot of visits where I wouldn't personally want to go and hang out there for a week. It's a lot of great programming and people and.
Do you think that there's a lot of pressure at this point towards maybe even the high-end retreat model of like sort of luxury vacation coinciding with medicine work? Is that something that I'm seeing a lot of these days, is like, we have the most luxurious, you know, bungalows for you. Here's the most beautiful beach in Mexico. Yeah,
I think that's true. And I think when if you spend some time on Fresh Minds, I think we've got 150 retreats listed at the moment. It's difficult to tell, like, who, you know, to find points of differentiation, right? Everybody's got a story and they're all, you know, various forms of credentials and experience and personal journeys and different modalities they introduce and features. And this one's got a pool and that one's got a hot tub and hey, we got a temescal that we built ourselves. And I think it's just really difficult to decide as a consumer, like, to find some differentiation here. So what we've tried to do is to, you know, in this selector tool, you know, have somebody get a sense for the type of experience they want to have, right? Whether it's, you know, sort of a really difficult journey, kind of like an ayahuasca experience, or whether it's, you know, something really earthy in nature and community, or whether they want to sort of, you know, have that really spiritual journey. I don't even think people understand the differences of the experience they're likely to have depending on the plant medicine that they're working with. So, you know, we're trying to help people figure out, like, well, what are those decision points to decide, like, do I go with A, B, C, D, F, Z? And what really matters to me in my personal sort of selection? And then how do I find who those people are?
Yeah. So let's talk about more of like the interface here at Fresh Minds. So like when we land on the page, we've got up at the top menu, we've got psychedelic retreats, psilocybin retreat guide, ayahuasca retreat guide, education, therapy. So what are the ways that people would be utilizing the information that you've gathered here? And Also, maybe just tell us a little bit again about, is it every retreat you find gets included in this directory? Is I know you said that you don't want to be the police for any of this, but yeah. Are there a certain criteria that you're looking for in inclusion in this, or is it just with the idea of we're going to catalog everything we find?
Yeah, I think it is much more around that. You know, like I said, when data presents itself that tells me, okay, you actually can't work with these guys for whatever reason, we will act on it. That hasn't really happened up to this point. And, you know, to put a really fine point on it, I met a couple of dudes in Mexico, one of whom I'll tell you, I left the facility saying I think he was bumping rails before I got there for hours because he was manic. And later on, you know, when I was checking out some of the marketing materials that they had on their own site, he was exactly the same as he was when I met him that day. And, you know, coming out of there, I was kind of like, oh, I don't know, I wouldn't send anybody there necessarily. He seemed a little off, but I suddenly realized, like, you're making a subjective call there, and you don't really have anything specific to go on. So, I think what we want to do is just help people to figure out, like, what are those really critical decision points that need to be made, you know, and then from that, give them as many options as possible. I think that's the beauty of a marketplace, especially when you've got so many options. It's the ability to compare one versus another, right? So, you know, how does this stack up versus that one, and how do I sort of make that decision? And having as many options as possible gives the consumer the best opportunity to make that choice.